YUN interview with Gunnar Jarring in Stockholm, Sweden, at his office, November 7th, on a Wednesday. The interviewer is Jane Krasny. This is an interview with Gunnar Jarring. So, just for the record, Mr. Jarring, could you explain your first contact with the United Nations, and then we could discuss your involvement with Dag Hammarskjöld and when you first heard that he was selected Secretary General?
Well, my contacts with the United Nations started with in 1952 when I became the head of the political department of the Swedish Foreign Office.
I see, okay.
And in those days, Hammarskjöld was Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs.
Yeah.
So we had, I would say, daily contacts about things which were happening in the world and which were related to Swedish foreign policy. And then in March 53, as far as I remember, he was appointed Secretary General.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, my contacts with him became less until I was appointed Swedish representative at the United Nations.
Yes.
On the 1st of May, 56.
In the 1st of May, all right. Mm-hmm.
And I remained as a Swedish ambassador to the UN until the 1st of July, 58, when I was appointed Swedish ambassador to Washington.
To Washington, yes.
But I continued to be Sweden's representative on the Security Council for the whole 2 years we were on the Council, 57 and 58.
Uh-huh.
So I had a double capacity of being ambassador in Washington and Sweden's representative on the Security Council for the second half of 58.
Yeah, that's an interesting way that they did that.
And then I was appointed by Jutta Hunt as his special representative on the Middle East question in November 57. And I was active until 73. As far as I remember, my last deal with the question was in August 73.
Mm-hmm.
And since then I have remained inactive, although I'm still the representative.
Yes.
And that's the whole story.
That's the story. All right. So then just to cover some of those things in more detail, when Hammarskjöld was told that he was selected to become Secretary General, were you the first here to hear about
that?
Well,
as a matter of fact, I went, presented him with a cable telling him that he had been appointed.
I see.
But that was just a formality.
Yeah.
Because it came in the line.
So, what was his reaction?
Well, I've given his reaction in one of my, I've written four volumes of memoirs in Swedish, and I've dealt with the case, his reaction also. It was more or less, but is there no possibility to get rid of it?
So at first he was not...
His first reaction was more or less, how can I ever do it, and so on. But of course he calmed down very quickly and accepted it without any protestations.
And then he turned out to be a very strong leader.
Yeah, I think he was.
Yes. So then you became the Swedish representative to the United Nations. And what things were you involved with at the UN during that period?
Well, during our 2 years, when I started in 56 in May, of course, then came in October all the very great problems about the Middle East, the war, the British-French attack on
right,
Egypt,
right.
And at the same time the Hungarian question.
Mm-hmm.
They were
exactly
they came
the same
at the same time.
Yeah.
And the Security Council was meeting in the morning, dealing with the Middle East, and in the afternoon with the with the Hungarian question, or vice versa.
And the, Sweden was on the Security Council.
No, we were not.
Oh, at that time you were not.
We came on the Security Council on the 1st of January, 57.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So we only were onlookers, or when the question was up in the General Assembly, which it was more or less the whole time. Then of course we participated.
Yeah.
But we were not in the Security Council until the 1st of January.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And during our 2 years in the Security Council, well, the first question I was involved in was the Kashmir dispute in February 57, and I was appointed the Security Council's representative on that question. So
that
I
question.
Spent, as far as I remember, March and part of April in India and Pakistan for the Security Council.
Right, right.
Then, of course, a running question the whole time was the Middle East,
right,
the
right.
aftermath of the
right, right.
what happened in 56. We had other things. Yes, well, then came, of course, the really great and dangerous question, that was the Lebanese affair in 58.
Right, right.
Lebanon and Iraq also.
Right,
at the same
right.
time.
So a lot was going on in the Middle East. Well, I have some questions about the Suez crisis that I wanted to ask you. Now, in your participation at the UN and in the General Assembly at that time, during that summer, shortly after you had come to the United Nations, then Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal.
Yes, yes.
And the British and French reaction to that was
well, we were
disapproval.
Not involved. Our foreign minister in those days, Undén, he was involved in it because he was a member of the committee set up by the users organization.
Yes,
the,
yes, right.
Of the canal.
Right, right.
He was personally involved in it. We were not involved. In the UN in those days, we just followed the debate.
Right, yeah.
And had a few things to say, but not, this was not dramatic at all.
Were you aware of any informal talks that were going on at the UN between Great Britain, France, and Egypt?
We were not involved in those days at all. Because we were outside the Security Council, and everything was done in the Council.
So after the crisis, then the UN became involved, declared ceasefire, and then there was a resolution to establish the first emergency force.
Yes, there I was involved. That was before our time on the Council.
It was still just before.
Because I've written about it in the, what's called again, the Military History Review.
Military
about
History
Sweden's
Review.
Participation in the UNEF and so on. And, well, it was, as a UN ambassador, I was just a go-between between the Secretary General and the Swedish government, because we set up the contingency for United Nations Emergency Force in those days.
Right.
But
right.
that was administration and nothing else.
But this was the first time that UN forces had been used.
Yes. It was organized by the Secretary General and his military advisors.
Right. And Sweden offered to send forces.
Yes.
And did they also send equipment and?
Well, the forces were equipped with the necessary equipment that, that was on.
Yeah, you provided your own
yes.
equipment for your soldiers. And And so Sweden must have approved of the UN sending forces.
Yes, of course we did, because it was peacekeeping forces, and it was in the sense of the United Nations to participate
right.
in peacekeeping forces.
Yeah.
We followed it the whole time, and we have always been active in that field.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And according to your experience at the UN, was Egypt unsure in the beginning about having forces on its territory, or
didn't catch it.
In the beginning, when was planned to send the emergency force to Egypt, it was agreed that they would be on Egyptian soil and not on Israeli soil.
Yes. So it was on Egyptian soil.
Yeah.
Israelis have always refused.
Have refused, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Were the Egyptians unsure about it, or were they, did they?
No, as far as I remember, they accepted it willingly and felt that it was in the, both in the interest of the country itself and as a UN action for preserving peace, or at least trying.
Yeah, yeah. So then when you became a part of the Security Council in January of 1957, were there still discussions going on about the Suez and establishing the forces there?
The force was already established, but there were so many incidents happening between Israel and countries.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole year of 57, and as far as I remember, 58 also, all kinds of minor or bigger things happened. So the question came up very often. You can see it from the records.
Yeah. And so were you personally involved in some of those discussions? Israel was reluctant to leave Sharm el-Sheikh, for example.
Yeah, well, we were not involved in detail, because Dag Hammarskjöld had his mandate to organize everything. He had a very wide mandate, and he did it himself. And of course we kept, I would like to mention that we had a very close cooperation with the Canadians.
Yes.
Lester Pearson
was the
Secretary of State or Foreign Minister in those days. And we were a group of countries that were active in peacekeeping. Sweden, Norway, Canada especially, and so on. So we kept in very close touch.
Well, I've noticed over the years that Sweden has sent forces in the Congo and at various different
times. That's later. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a particular reason why Sweden has been so willing to become involved?
Well, of course, if I put it this way, we like to believe that Sweden was specially suited for supplying forces, because we were small country, neutral country,
neutral, yeah.
And not involved in the conflicts like the great powers. As I say, we like to believe this.
Yes,
yeah.
right. And then you became the ambassador to Washington.
Yes.
And as you said, you still.
I continued in the Security Council, because I was appointed to Washington on the 1st of July, and it was in the middle of the Middle East crisis about Lebanon.
Yes, yes.
And our foreign minister felt that it was better I continued, as I have been involved in it the whole time before.
Right, right.
So I had nothing to do with the UN except with the Security Council for that half year, 58
right.
years.
Right.
And that was the peak of the Lebanon crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, everything happened in Iraq, where the king and his whole government was murdered and killed, and
mm-hmm.
there was a revolution.
Yeah,
it all came at the same time.
Everything was happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then at in 1967, the Egyptians had asked for the emergency force in the Sinai to be withdrawn.
Yeah, I was not involved because that was before my appointment.
Right. So, and then at that time, Luthant was the Secretary General.
Yes.
And then he had asked you to become a special representative.
Yes.
And when approximately did he contact you about that?
Well, he didn't contact me until the resolution was accepted by the Security Council, Resolution 242.
Yes, right. Okay.
But of course, I knew that I was in the picture already a month or a couple of months earlier.
All right. Uh-huh.
But not through Utan.
Oh,
that
who?
Was the gossip.
That was the gossip.
Yes.
That you would be asked to be
yes,
a special representative.
Uh-huh. So. I got
for a few months before that, then they had been talking
about. I was
ambassador
in Moscow in those days.
Oh, I see.
Swedish ambassador in Moscow.
To Moscow.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I got, as soon as the resolution 242 was taken,
mm-hmm. that would
I
be
got
in
a
November,
cable
yeah.
from a Utant asking mm-hmm. me to accept the
mm-hmm.
charge
mm-hmm.
as special representative,
mm-hmm.
as his special representative, which I did.
Yeah.
Immediately left for the UN.
Uh-huh.
So that was, I think, 24th, 25th of November.
Of November, right, right. Mm-hmm. I remember reading that as early as May of 1967, he had suggested that there be a special representative.
Yeah, well, that came in connection with the June War.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, you remember it started, the war started, as far as I remember, the 2nd of June.
Yeah, it's right around there, right at the beginning of June.
And the Security Council dealt with the issue the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it came up very early about how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there were different ideas and so
mm-hmm.
on. But I don't know when he himself thought of sending a special representative, but I suppose it was in his mind
mm-hmm,
at
mm-hmm.
an early stage.
Right, right.
Mm.
So do you have any idea of why he decided to ask you to do this?
Well, I don't know exactly what happened behind the scene there, but I think that Ralph Bunch
yes.
was active for my appointment.
Uh-huh.
Because he knew me from the time I dealt with the Kashmir issue in 57.
Okay, I see.
And Utant I knew very well personally also,
oh,
as
you
a
did.
Colleague in the,
uh-huh.
in the UN. So
mm-hmm.
I suppose that was contributing to my
mm-hmm.
selection of me for the job.
Right, right. So then you began your work as the special representative
immediately. Yeah.
And so you left Moscow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So then who did you see? Did you speak directly to both the Israelis and the Egyptians?
Well, I met my first trip in the area was, I don't remember exactly, but I think I went, the first stop was Lebanon, and then
mm-hmm.
next, I think, Jordan,
mm-hmm.
Amman,
mm-hmm.
next, Egypt and Israel, I think, as far as I remember, was the last one.
I see.
I met Nasser, of course,
yes.
King Hussein,
uh-huh.
and in Jerusalem. I don't remember who was the Prime Minister in those days, but...
Well, was it Golda Meir?
No, not much later.
Later.
It
mm-hmm.
was... well, anyhow, the persons or the my how to say counterparts were the foreign ministers in the three countries or four countries. Abba Ibn.
Abba Ibn, yeah.
And Riyadh.
Riyadh, yes.
And in Jordan it was the prime minister and the foreign minister and the king himself and so on.
Yes. And then in your dealings, what issues did you discuss with them? What were the primary issues?
Well, you know, I was not the mediator because the resolution 242 doesn't speak of mediation.
Oh,
it speaks of, well, I would say I felt my appointment more as a go-between. I had to try to find ways to solve the conflict optimistically.
Yes.
Or to find a way out anyhow to calm it down and so on. I started, as a matter of fact, with trying to find ways for softening the situation in the Middle East by, for example, exchange of prisoners of war and so on, which was more on the humanitarian side. And parallel with it, of course, I discussed the implementation of Resolution 242 with the parties concerned. But I took that humanitarian approach in order to soften their minds. And then it continues with endless conversations, endless meetings with the parties. It's a very, very long affair. With hundreds of meetings. Without result, in a way. On the other hand, I always defend myself by saying that at least I didn't make the thing worse than it was.
Well, what were some of the stalemate issues, though, that there just couldn't be agreement on?
You mean the main issue?
Well,
that was, of course, from the Arab side, that they insisted on Israel's withdrawal of their forces from the occupied territories. On Israel's side, it was, the main question was perhaps to get the Arab side to a negotiation table, to get them negotiate about the peace.
The Israelis wanted face-to-face negotiations, is that correct?
Yes, they wanted to sit at the same table with them, and the Arabs refused because they would have done it, they said, the day when Israel declared that they were willing to withdraw their forces
from the occupied territories.
And then, from again from the Israeli side, there was one, they insisted on secure and safe boundaries, which was a very complicated affair.
So that was written into 242.
Well, the words says 242 speaks of secure boundaries for all the countries concerned, not only for Israel, but for all of them.
But it isn't exactly clear in 242 what those boundaries are.
No, it was not declared, and that was one of the headaches, to find out what is a secure boundary. And there you have to take into consideration the changing technological world, because a boundary might have been safe 500 years ago, but not today with the modern military science. And so on.
It was with the use of missiles and aircraft.
And missiles.
Mm-hmm. So the Israelis defined a secure border differently than the Egyptians, or?
Well, neither side, we never got to a definition of what a secure boundary is or was.
Mm-hmm.
It was impossible. We have never got to it, and it remains the same today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's still not defined.
Right.
And it probably will never be defined.
But the issue of the exchange of prisoners of war, that was more easily resolved?
Well, that was solved. It was solved in a decent way,
mm-hmm.
after a couple of months. And both the all the very many Egyptian prisoners of war were returned,
mm-hmm.
with some missing, of course,
mm-hmm.
because all didn't come back. And a few Israeli prisoners of war were also returned, so that was all right. Another problem we had was to open up the secure the Suez Canal after the bombardment, where so many ships sunk and so on.
Yes, right.
I dealt with that also, but that we never got anywhere. It was much later that I found a solution to that problem. I was not involved in the final solution, but in the beginning I was very much.
And the other issue, freedom of passage through to the Gulf of Aqaba.
No,
that was not.
I didn't have anything to do with that.
And were you involved at all with the negotiations with Syria?
No.
At that time,
Syria didn't accept me.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't accept me because they didn't accept Resolution 242 in those days.
Uh-huh.
Syria was the only country that didn't accept it.
Uh-huh.
So I could never, I had no contact at all with the Syrians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was permitted to fly over their territory to Jordan, but that was all.
That was all, I see. But then you did meet with the Jordanians and King Hussein,
mm-hmm.
and the foreign minister at that time. I don't remember.
The prime minister of those days was Talhouni, and the foreign minister he's not alive anymore. No.
Well, we can think of it later. We can add it later. I think I should just stop the...